Okay. Started doing my own recording too. Okay. Yeah, so feel free.
Okay. So we have Dr. S.B. Forreston with us here today. He works primarily at Mass Gen Hospital and teaches at Harvard Medical School. He was born and raised in Spain and graduated from medical school at the University of Murcia. In the same university, he also completed a PhD on the history of psychiatry titled Demons, Fast and Death, Mental Health in the Late Middle Ages, in which he studied the approach to mental illness in Europe during the 13th and 14th centuries. As a result of the publications from his work, he was awarded Best PhD by the Health Science Program for the 2015-2016 academic years. He did a psychiatric residency then at Metro Health Medical Center in Cleveland. Following that, he completed a fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry at the University of Chicago and another fellowship in psycho-oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. He has over 20 peer-reviewed publications in a variety of aspects of psychiatry, such as psychedelics, side effects, inflammation, dissociative symptoms, history of psychiatry, and cinema. He's presented his work at most of the major academic meetings, including the APA, WPA, APM, ACAP, and AAAP. He's the founding editor of the Journal of Humanistic Psychiatry and the author of the book Monsters, Demons, and Psychopaths: Psychiatry and Horror Film. He hosts the Spanish psychiatry podcast, El Último Humanista, that focuses on psychiatry, philosophy, art, music, history, and cinema. His major interests are philosophy, art history, rock music, gastronomy, and cinema. Whenever you're ready, Dr. S. Forreston, you can come.
Yeah, the system, because of Zoom, or maybe it's the Mac computer, is not letting me share with Zoom right now the slides. But I send you, if you open the PDF, maybe we can go through them in the PDF. Because when I click on share screen, maybe it's my computer. Let me see if I go to advanced, virtual background, or basic. Oh, here, I have some technical assistance here. Maybe they can help me. Hold on. This is like a share screen here. When I click, I can go to basic. The PowerPoint, open system preference. The PowerPoint is here. Let me go on keynote. Yeah. Share screen. Yeah, it's usually the Mac is the one. Whiteboard, I will go to the desktop one. Keynote, I know. Share. Yeah. I mean, it can be the screen. If I can share the screen, it would be enough. Do you have, Conrad, the slides that I send you, maybe?
I have the PDF. Do you like me to pull that out for you?
Yeah, you pull it out. Maybe I can just go through the PDF, because it happened to me last time. I don't know why, when I share in some presentations, it says open system preference. And when I open system preferences, the window. You access Apple ID. It's Zoom. I think it's Zoom, what we had to say, or the keynote. Let me save keynote.
Sure.
Yeah, in the email.
But I can share my screen.
Yeah, you can share your screen, and then I'll tell you to next slide. Because I think that happened last time. And I don't know why. These are things that. Okay, perfect. So we can use that. Yeah. Okay. So I'll say next every time. You know, I want you to go to the next slide. So well, thank you everybody for being here today. I want to thank Conrad for inviting me and everybody at Loyola. I really enjoy this opportunity of talking at Loyola, because it's really a humanist place, and I think there's definitely space for humanism here, and this is where I have dedicated my life and my career, to psychiatry and humanism. So I'm very happy that there is an interest here at Loyola. You know, hopefully we can expand this humanism. And so today Conrad told me, what would you like to talk about? I thought witchcraft, could be an interesting theme. It's a theme that I have been interested in for the last few years, and especially because I think there is some psychiatric aspects of witchcraft that are pertinent for psychiatric discussion and analysis. So said so, I'm gonna do like a brief interview of the history of witchcraft, and then from there I'm going to discuss particularly focus on the case of Salem, I think, which is more interesting for people in the US, and then I will talk a little bit about some lessons learned and some psychiatric discussion about it. So the painting that you can see there is an engraving by Albert Durer, who was from Germany, and he was a Catholic background, and he had an interest in witchcraft, and you can see like the depiction of a witch in the 16th century. So, next slide. Okay, so witchcraft, black magic, and spells have been a constant in history since the beginning of civilization. And actually, in for example, we can see examples of witchcraft or black magic or spells in Egypt, Mesopotamia, and also in antiquity with the Greek and the Romans. There were spells, history of spells, and even laws, for example, in the Code of Hammurabi. Like if you go to the University of Chicago Museum, Oriental Museum, you can see a copy of the Code of Hammurabi. And one of the laws in the Code of Hammurabi in Mesopotamia was to prevent people from doing spells and black magic. So that has been a constant, spells and black magic and accusations of black magic throughout history. But it was more in the 15th century, and I say that because during the early Middle Ages, despite there were accusations, it was not acknowledged as something that was possibly real, that people could take it seriously from a legal viewpoint. But it was more in the 15th century that there was an opinion that really black magic could be a real thing. But throughout the 14th and 15th century, when the Inquisition started, the Inquisition was not a Spanish thing. The Spanish Inquisition is very popular, but the Inquisition is something that started in France in the 14th century, and then it was in Germany, and it was in Italy. And the Inquisition never acknowledged the witchcraft. They never acknowledged witches. But it became more important later on, especially during the Renaissance. But during the late Middle Ages and early Middle Ages, it was not a very a phenomena. It was not like a movement. It was like these massive accusations that happened later on. That became more typical of the Renaissance. There were occasional accusations of black magic and witchcraft, but it was not a very frequent thing in society, in European society. So here we see an example of 15th century accusation of a witch in Switzerland where she was burned on a stake. So usually if somebody was accused of being a witch, at that time the way to get rid of the spell was to burn the witch at the stake. So that was the solution to the problem, you know, as per theology view of the point. So let's go to next slide. Yeah, so it was actually after 1447, Heinrich Kramer, he was an inquisitor, but he was a German inquisitor, actually, in the Catholic world in Germany. Well, at that time, German was Catholic as well. You know, it was before the Reform and Lutheranism. And he was part of the Inquisition, and he wrote a book called Malleus Maleficarum. And this book became a bestseller across Europe. It was written in Latin, and it spread all over Europe. This, when I was a psych resident and I was studying for Pride, I think there was a very old Pride exam where you had a question about Malleus Maleficarum, because in history, this book has been seen as a book that was used for propaganda against the mentally ill, because the mentally ill were more vulnerable to being accused of being a witch. I mean, you had to accuse somebody. The homeless, the outcast, the mentally ill are going to be more frequently accused of witchcraft. So this used to be a history of psychiatry question back in the day. Malleus Maleficarum means literally the hammer of the witches, because the Maleficarum is the evil people and the maleficarum, and the malus is the hammer. So you want to hammer the witches, you want to kill the witches, you want to accuse the witches, you had to detect them. So he had a whole ontology and a whole description of what witches were and how the problem of witchcraft should be addressed. And he really was a defendant that witches were real and that was a big problem in society and we had to solve the problem. And that really spread the idea in society that witchcraft was a real problem in society that had to be taken care of. And this book became, like I said, a bestseller. I think after the Bible was the most popular book at the time. I mean, this is, you know, after Gutenberg had the printing method, so it could be spread easily, at least throughout the Latin Europe. We call in Europe in the 15th century, everything was published in Latin. Even in England, everything was published in Latin, and we call Latin Europe. You know, Latin Europe is how this message could be spread. Yeah, we can go to next book, next slide, sorry. So after Maleus Maleficarum got published, there was really a belief in society. It took like a few decades to really become more and more and more real. In which there was really witchcraft could be a problem that had to be taken care of. And also it became an opportunity to accuse political opponents. So that's the whole story of witch hunt that happened in Europe for two or three centuries and later on in the United States. The people think nowadays, if you go to Salem, I mean, we just had Halloween recently, and people go crazy and they go to Salem and they dress up like witches. And many people nowadays, they feel they are witches and they are psychic readers and so on. Now it's like a fancy, cool thing to be a witch. In the 16th century or in the 15th century, the last thing you want to be called is a witch. You know, a witch is like being called nowadays a Nazi or a fascist or something like that. Like nobody wants to be a witch. Nobody wants to be in the 16th century as the same as nobody wants to be a Nazi nowadays. Now it's cool to be a witch. At that time, it was not cool to be a witch. So it was used as a way to accuse the person of the worst thing you can be, so to the point that you would deserve execution. And the first massive witch trial, actually one of the first massive witch trials, they were like isolated witch trials all over for 100 or 200 years, but the first massive one happened in Trier, in Germany, the Trier witch trials. It happened for over a decade, and at that time there was the archbishop of the city of Trier. He was concerned because there was a problem of sterility in society. Sterility, like people were sterile, like there were no newborn children. They didn't know what could be the cause. Maybe it was some disease or something going on. But this archbishop thought the problem is that there is some witchcraft activity going on, and that's why people cannot have children anymore. So this archbishop, who was a Catholic, he accused the Protestants, because this is the time that Protestantism was increasing in Germany. He then accused the Jews, and ultimately he said it was a problem of witchcraft and anybody could be guilty of the problem. So he started doing his own research, and he started looking for possible people who were being accused of witchcraft, and he started trials and executions, and there were like 396 executions. Overly, more or less like 600 to 700 people were tried, and there were 396 executions, and of these 396 executions, they were burned at the stake. So they were put at the stake, and they were burned in flames in order to solve the problem. According to Maleus Maleficarum, he said that was the problem of solving the problem, to burn people in the fire, and that's how they did it. And this is a contemporary pamphlet that you're seeing there of the witchcraft trials in Trier in Germany at the time. It's a contemporary one. So let's go to next. Then later on, this really impacted other trials. People learned about the Trier witch trials, and this became popular in Denmark, and in Copenhagen they learned about it. And at that time, the king of Scotland married the prince of Denmark. This king was James the Sixth of Scotland. And he went from Scotland to Denmark, and when he went there, he found like storms. And they had the idea, they were impacted by the Trier witch trials, and they really believed they were witches. And he said, okay, so if there are witches, the storms that I encounter in my ship were probably caused by witchcraft activity. Like there might be some witches that caused my boat to fail, and they found like some, you know, like things that were broken in the boats and stuff, and they say all these problems are caused by witchcraft activity, and that's why I could face the storm, but it was difficult for me to go from Scotland to Denmark. So this is an obvious case of witchcraft activity. And they started a tribunal for witchcraft in Denmark, and also he went back to Scotland and he found another storm, James VI, and he did his own tribunal and he participated in the tortures and the executions of the witches himself, the king himself, and eventually this ended up in like 30 to 40 trials and 17 executions at that time, and it was directly impacted, and it's called the Copenhagen witch trials and the North Berwick in Scotland witch trials of 1590, directly impacted by the Trier witch trial. So here we see how psychiatrically we see this phenomena in which witch trials are spreading. It becomes like a gossip thing, like a rumor, like a massive hysteria or like a propaganda. It becomes like a sociological phenomena that can travel from one country to another. So next. This is another image of the contemporary pamphlet of the time of the North of the Witches of Scotland, the North Berwick trials, and you can see the devil represented as a black goat or a black monster, and the witches being accused and being fired. They are preparing the fire on the right side, and you can see the boats as well, because there are the boats that were damaged. And this is from the time. This is how they explained to the people what was going on. Okay. Next. Then in France, we had the Labourd witch trials. It's Labourd. There were some witch accusations in the north, and there were accusations in Paris from very early on as well, and in Normandy as well. But the most significant were in the area of Basque Country, Navarre of France. Basque Country is between Spain and France, and people know Basque Country in Spain, but this part of the Basque Country is also in France, and people spoke Basque there. And in Navarre, where you have Pamplona, the running of the bulls, that's also Navarre is part of the old Basque Country. And there started to be accusations, like these rumors that there was witchcraft activity, that this could really happen, started to expand. And that was probably impacted also. This witchcraft in Europe became so big because this is the time of a lot of religious convulsion. This is the time of the 30 Years' War. I don't know if you study in the U.S. the 30 Years' War, but the 30 Years' War is a war that happened between 1610 and 1630-something, 1640, and this is the time of the Reform and the Counter-Reform, and there was a lot of struggle between Catholicism and all the Protestant movements, and from all the Protestant movements, then you get, in England, you get Anglicanism after Henry VIII, and from Anglicanism, you get an English Civil War between the Puritans who were fighting the Anglicans because they thought that the Anglicans were too Catholic, and these Anglicans who were too Catholic, they wanted to purify themselves. And this is what originated the myth of the pilgrims of the United States. When you talk about the Mayflower, these were pilgrims who at that time, during the 30 Years' War, the pilgrims of the Mayflower, the ones who arrived in Plymouth, they were against the Anglicans because they thought the Anglicans were too Catholic and they wanted to be more Protestant or more Puritan or whatever. And then they went to Holland in Leiden, and then from Leiden they got kicked out because they were Protestants, but they still got kicked out from Holland, despite in Holland you had Protestants at the time. And eventually they had to go to England, but an England that was more permissive with their Puritanism, and that's how they settled in Massachusetts, and they started Plymouth, which is part of the foundational myth of the United States. And this is part of the 30 Years' War. So during all this religious convulsion, all these political fights, witch hunts becomes a perfect tool to accuse your opponent. So if you were Catholic, you can accuse the Protestants of witchcraft. Nobody wanted to be a witch. But if you were in Germany and in the Holy Roman Empire, which is Germany, Switzerland, etc., if you were a Protestant and you wanted to accuse the Catholics, you would accuse them of witchcraft. And that's what was happening. So in Germany, especially in South France, France. This person, the Archbishop, called Pierre Lancard, he executed 70 people of witchcraft, and they were burned at the stake, and there were many trials, but 70 people were accused in South France and executed. And this is, I'm reviewing some of the most famous witch trials. Let's go to next. This impacted the most famous witch trials of Spain, which is in Basque Country, in Sugarramurdi is the name of the town. I visited myself Sugarramurdi one of the last times I was in Spain. And this is still legends nowadays. Like when you go there, you can do the witch tour, like in Salem a little bit. You can visit the witch where allegedly the witches used to gather together and so on. So influenced by the French Basque region, in the Spanish Basque regions, other people started accusing each other of witchcraft. You can see how the phenomena spreads geographically as soon as people learn about it and they start, you know, becoming aware of it. There were trials in Logroño, in where you have Logroño is the capital of Rioja. Everybody probably is familiar with Rioja wine, Spanish wine, Rioja. So there in Logroño you have the Tribunal of the Inquisition, and there the Vallejo was the inquisitor. He accused 20 or 30 people, I don't know, and he executed 6 people, but 5 people died in prison. That was something, a common thing, because the prison conditions were not good and people would die in prison while awaiting their trial. So 6 people were burned at the stake, and 5 or 6 people died in prison. So approximately 12 people died as a result of these witch trials. But for good, the Inquisition never acknowledged witch trial as a real thing. So then there was another inquisitor called Alonso de Salazar Frias. And this person interviewed up to 2,000 people for witchcraft activity. And he saw no evidence of witchcraft activity. And he ended the hysteria of witchcraft activity in Spain. So next. Oh, and before we go to next, there was another slide that I added later. But I couldn't share in this PDF. But in England, it's very interesting, because in England there was a person called Matthew Hopkins, and this Matthew Hopkins, there was a civil war, and this is the time that Anglicanism was having their own sects, like Puritans and all these people that eventually many of them started the pilgrimage and the United States as, or the myths of the United States. But during that time, this person, Matthew Hopkins, he saw an opportunity to make profit out of witchcraft, and he started going all over the city saying, in your city there are witches and you don't know about it, and I have a method to identify witches. And in this method, so you see all different kind of psychological behaviors. In his method, he added more on it. He said, we can do a confession, but we cannot get a confession. We can do a physical exam and look for the marks of the devil. Or we can do a skin picking and see based on the skin picking, based on the reaction to skin picking, if the person is a witch. Or we can put the person on water, and if the person cannot float on water, then the person might be a witch. So he made up all this method to find witches, and he is responsible for hundreds of accusations and executions as well. This Matthew Hopkins in England. And in England, for some reason, the Puritans didn't learn much about the Maleus Maleficarum, and they started hanging people instead. So many of the witches in England were hanged instead of burned in flames. And this is interesting, because at that time, in 1645, that's when Matthew Hopkins was doing that, in Massachusetts Bay Colony, there were already witchcraft accusations as well. And there was one or two executions at that time in 1645. So it was happening in the Crown of England across, the seas in America already. So let's go to next. Yeah, this is the total number of executions that happened in Europe at the time. So it's estimated that in Great Britain, there were like 5,000 accusations. This is between the 15th century and the 18th century. Witchcraft accusations ended in the 18th century. But most of the executions actually happened during the 16th century. Like I said before, it's the time of the 30 Years' War, where is the reform and the counter-reform. And it was really used for political rivals. So many political rivals were well accused, and they died being accused as of witchcraft. So in England, you get like between 1,500 and 2,000 executions in those 300 years. In the Holy Roman Empire, which is German, Netherlands, Switzerland, Lorraine, Austria, and Czechia, you get between 50,000. Germany, you know, gets a little bit like the top, 25,000 and 30,000 executions. Scandinavia, you get between 3,000 accusations and 1,000 executions. In Eastern Europe, you get like 7,000 and 2,000 executions. And in Southern Europe, between Spain, Portugal, and Italy, I tell you, I mean, I don't want to be, you know, like I'm not a nationalist, patriotic guy, but sometimes the Spanish Inquisition gets the whole, you know, they become the image of the witchcraft and the executions. And I'm as a Spaniard, when I'm walking around, everybody tell me, yeah, the Spanish Inquisition are the ones who did all the burn all the witches, you know. You get between Spain, Portugal, and Italy, where you had Inquisition in Spain, Portugal, and Italy, in the three of them, you get like 10 accusations, 1,000 executions. Okay, so, yeah, and at that time in Massachusetts, we'll talk about it, but in the U.S. it's very rare. We get like about 25 executions only. So U.S. did a better job, you know. Okay, so let's go to next slide. So let's talk about Salem, because it's, you know, what everybody knows about it. Everybody has watched the movie Hocus Pocus, and Salem Witch Trials. And right now has become Salem. I don't know if you guys have been here, but I've been here a few times because I live in Boston now. It has become a little bit of the Disneyland of the witches, and everybody comes here to dress up like a witch, and it's very cool to be a witch, and you go there and they read your cards, and you go to the satanic temples, and everybody thinks it's very cool to be a witch. But at that time, it was by no means, it was a cool thing. It was not cool to be a witch at all. So it's just to put things in context. What really happened in Salem, if we think about it, was a tragedy. It was a tragedy of people being fakely accused and people dying for it. So with Puritanism, like I explained before, just to put people in context, the first Puritans arrived, well, the first Puritans, the some of the first people arrived in... well, you have Jamestown, and you have in Canada as well. But in the U.S., people like the myth of the Plymouth and the Mayflower because they were anti-monarchic. So if they were anti-monarchic, despite they were allowed to stay within the monarchy territory, it served the purpose of creating the myth of the future United States. So a lot of people pay attention to that. But the Puritans were really, what they really wanted to do is they wanted to separate themselves from Anglicanism because they thought Anglicanism was too Catholic, and also probably there were taxes involved as well. And then they went to Holland and they settled in Massachusetts, and then a lot of people continued to arrive at the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And then later on, in the, I don't remember if it was 1634 or something, but the first college is founded here. John Harvard was from Stratford upon Avon. He was neighbor with Shakespeare family, actually. And then he was in London, and from London he came to Boston area, and he settled himself in Charlestown, and he had his house there. And with some graduates from Cambridge University, in Newtown, they wanted to fund Cambridge College, but then he died at 28 years old, John Harvard. And then because he was the major donor, they just renamed the Cambridge College as Harvard College, and Newtown became Cambridge Town. But this Harvard College in the 17th century is completely different from nowadays. Harvard College was a theology school. Harvard himself was a clergy person. And you would go there to study theology. I mean, that was only in the 18th century Harvard starts to become secular. By that time, it was just a theology school. And the president of Harvard, one of the first presidents, was Increase Mather. And Increase Mather was well familiar, and you can see the painting here of Increase Mather, a contemporary painting of him. Increase Mather was well familiar with Malleus Maleficarum. And he wrote in his writings that witchcraft was real and the devil was real, and if the devil is real, the witches must be real. That was the logicality that they used at the time. And also he was a witness of the witch trials in Salem, and he wrote supporting about it and never apologized for it. And he was also the president of Harvard for a long time. And so he wrote, after the witch accusations, he wrote Cases of Conscience Concerning Evil Spirits, to continue to support what they had down there. And he attended himself in person the execution of one of these witches, which is George Burroughs, who was a priest. He was the priest of Salem at the time, who had left Salem. That's when we see the political rivalry. He had left Salem village because he said they were not paying his full salary. And then he was accused of being a witch after that, you know? So the, you see the opportunism here. So let's go to next slide. Cotton Mather was the son of Increase Mather. He wanted to be the president of Harvard, but because Salem was condemned later on, many people apologized, including some of the witnesses and some of the judges. Then he couldn't become the president of Harvard. But he graduated at Harvard too, and in 1693, a year later after the executions, he attended the executions as well, and he never apologized for it, and he wrote Invisible Wonders of the World, still to justify his publication that the witches were real and the witchcraft was a problem that had to be taken care of. And these are the Puritan people, and in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, church and state were of course not separated, and it was completely dominated by their, you know, you could say radical religiosity or more extreme religiosity of the people who, what the reason they were coming here is because they wanted to be more pure Christians without Catholic influence that they thought Anglicanism had. Okay, so next. They, both of them, Increase Mather and Cotton Mather, who are the technically the ones who funded the ideology and the ontology and the theory of witchcraft practice, and this is what really, you know, allowed this thinking in society. They were like the ideology people or the theoricians of all this. Both of them are buried in Boston, and you can still visit their gravestone. You can see where their houses was intact until the 20th century in the North End in Boston. But in Cobbs Hill Cemetery, that became important later on in history because during the U.S. Revolution, Cobbs Hill was used by the British to siege Charleston, the Bunker Hill Battle. But there you can see the gravestone of both of them together. For people who are in Chicago, they might be interested because you can see Increase Mather, Cotton Mather, and you can see the grandchild in the same gravestone. But the great-grandchild or the great-great-grandchild went to Chicago, actually. And if you go to Chicago, you have the Mather Tower in Chicago, which is a little bit of a witchy tower that you can see by... I forgot, on the river in downtown Chicago. It's like a Gothic tower that is octagonal tower from the 19th century. That tower was ordered by the great-grandchild of Increase Mather. Yeah, it's called the Mather Tower still. I mean, you can check it out in Google, the Mather Tower in Chicago. Okay, so next. So this is how everything started. So it's in a very innocent manner. So there are two girls. We're going to analyze this particular case because it's very interesting. This is the house where everything started. It was standing until the 20th century, and then they tore it down. And if you go to Danvers, Massachusetts, because it's not Salem, the city of Salem. It's the Salem Village. So it has many cities around. So everything started here in Danvers, Massachusetts, which is within the old Salem Village. And nowadays, you can go to Danvers, Massachusetts. I mean, it's a cool place to visit. And you can visit the grounds of this house that are still there, actually. So this is the house where it started. And there were, like I said before, George Burroughs was the reverend of the area, the priest of the area. And he decided to quit because they were not paying him enough money. And they put Reverend Sam Parris. Sam Parris had the daughter. His daughter was Betty Parris. Betty Parris and Abigail Williams, another girl, they were playing with an egg. At that time, they were doing the divinization of the egg. Umansi was called, where they would put an egg on a glass, and looking at the egg and the shape of the egg, they would try to guess who's going to be their next husband. They were 13, 14. At that time, people would get married when they were teenagers. They said, who's going to be my husband? And looking at the egg, they would try to guess who was going to be their husband. And after that, they had a, you know, what we would call now functional neurological disorder or conversion, hysteria in the 19th century. And they started having like seizures-like activity, like conversion or functional neurological disorder. So Reverend Parris said, what's going on here? And he sent the girls to the physician of the Salem Village, which was William Griggs. And William Griggs didn't say evidence for any disease or epilepsy. And he said, maybe they are victims of witchcraft. So he ordered the Indian, they had an Indian, Latin American, Indian mixed slave, Reverend Parris, and he ordered her, he said, order her to order a witch cake. And the witch cake was to make a cake and give it to each a dog, And then the dog has to urinate, and if the dog had the same symptoms or something, the cake was made with the urine of the girls. So you make the cake with the urine of the girls. You give it to the dog, and if the dog has seizures, then that's definitely witchcraft. That was the proof in their mind. So that's what the physician actually argued that they had to do. So they did that, and they saw seizures in the dog as well, and they said, okay, this is witchcraft. So they immediately accused the slave of being the witch. You know, you had to accuse somebody, of course. Minorities are going to be discriminated. They are discriminated nowadays. At that time, even more, or the same. So Tituba gets accused. Tituba was smart enough to say, okay, yeah, I'm a witch. So because she knew that if you say that you're a witch, you wouldn't be executed. And if you accuse other people, then you could be safe. So she accused, which people she accused? She accused Sarah Good and Sarah Osborne. Sarah Good and Sarah Osborne, also to mention, Abigail Williams talked to three other friends who started the accusations, and one of them was Ann Putman Jr., who accused up to 70 people. Ann Putman Jr., another girl, she was 16 at the time. Three girls under age make all the accusations at the beginning, and I started the accusations. So Tituba knew that Ann Putman Jr. and other people, they knew they had problems with Sarah Good, because Sarah Good had inherited money from her prior husband, and instead of passing to the children of her prior husband, she married a new Irish guy, and Irish people were less popular among the Puritans, and she decided to keep the estate for herself. So the Putman family, they were angry at that because they were inheritors of that estate. So she got accused of that. Another person was Sarah Osborne, and Sarah Osborne had a lot of problems with Reverend Sam Parris. So, you know, Betty Parris, who is the daughter of Sam Parris, maybe is going to accuse the person who used to make fun of Sam Parris, and they had a couple of struggles at the time. So you can see how the human psychology works in order to decide who you're going to accuse. Even nowadays, if you are going to get accused of whatever, of not following some policy or being inappropriate or showing inappropriate behavior at work, who's going to get accused? The people that are like the least, you know, this is what happens nowadays as well. This is how human psychology works. So this is where it started. Let's go to next slide. Well, so yeah, this is, I'm writing an article now actually for an art history journal in Spain about the 19th century depiction of the witchcraft. So we have the houses, we have the portraits of some of the people at the time, but we don't have the depictions of the witchcraft. We have the accusations and the trials because they were all like written and transcribed. And you can see the digital document at Virginia. If you go to the University of Virginia, you can see all the documents. The original ones are there. I don't know why they're at University of Virginia, but they're digitalized. So when I was doing my research, I had access to all the digital original documents of the Salem witchcraft accusations. So this is a depiction of the 19th century for the 300th anniversary. In the 200, it was, no, sorry. It was the 200th anniversary. So 200 years later, in 1892, there was an interest during Romanticism, and they were saying, where are the witchcrafts? And people started saying that the witches were buried in a mountain where they put now a monument. Now we have found that they were buried in several places. Most of the places are not located, but some of the bodies have been found with archaeological excavations. But there was an interest in that. There was an interest in recovering that, and it was, but some of the family members were still, you know, defending this, or they didn't do many monuments. And then in 1992, 300 years later, is when they started doing more monuments and more apology and so on. But even at the time, these accusations were heavily criticized. We have testimonies from a merchant from Boston who wrote about it, and he said that this is you know, it was crazy, it was unfair. And also one of the first judges that was proposed for the court, Nathaniel Stontal, he refused to be related to that as well. But Tituba, here we see a 200 years later depiction of Tituba, the Indian slave. You know, at that time, slavery was common in Massachusetts, and later on now it's different. You know, it's a more liberal state, but it's one of the first states it's one of the first states of the country, and the slavery was a normal thing. Even in Chris Mather, the president of Harvard, had one slave, and his slave, the name was Spaniard. That was the name of the slave of Chris Mather, Spaniard, you know? So I don't know if he was from Spain or they just called him Spaniard. But let's go to the next slide. So, yeah, the governor at the time was William Phipps during the witch trial, and when he saw the first accusation, he said, okay, so let's make a tribunal of Oyer and Terminer here, determine, and we're going to hear and determine based on our observations. The interesting thing is, like, in Massachusetts at that time, it was allowed to use spectral evidence. Like, even if you could prove that you were not there, you know, doing witchcraft and you were with other people and you had witness, they could say, well, but we saw your specter. So if you had the specter, that was good enough to do witchcraft. And it also allowed in England, because this was the England monarchy, use these techniques of Matthew Hopkins. So you can do a physical exam looking for marks of the devil, and you could execute the person. And two of the executions were based on physical exam without testimony. Two or three, I think. And many of the accusations were based on physical exams. And others were just on using spectral evidence. So people were executed based on spectral evidence. And other people were executed based on the interview, hearing the evidence, and make a determination. So those were the three techniques, just to see the concept of justice at the time. So this is William Phipps. Next slide. This William Stoughton, he was the chief of justice at the Salem trials, and he still have a city here in Massachusetts called Stoughton. You know, many people moved there to Stoughton. It's a relatively fancy place to live right now. This is his portrait at the time in the 17th century that you can see at the Harvard Museum of Art. So if you go, it's free on Sundays. So you go to the Harvard Museum of Art, you can see William Stoughton, who was, everybody here was involved with Harvard College, because these are all were graduate from Harvard. All these people. And he was the chief of justice. He was famous for his zealous methods. He was very strict. He really believed witches were real, and he really wanted to believe that most of the accusations were real. At some point, because another problem with justice, you could save your life by saying that you were a witch and accusing other people. So you were justifying that witches were real because you were acknowledging that you were a witch. And also, you could accuse other people. So then would spread the hysteria. At some point, half of the city of Salem Village, half of the people were accused in jail. And at some point, the wife of William Phipps, the governor, Lady Mary Phipps, she was accused of being a witch as well. That's when he decided to dissolve the tribunal, William Phipps. Okay, next slide. The judges in the end who agreed to participate were Samuel Sewall. Here we have a painting of the time, a contemporary painting of Samuel Sewall. And John Hawthorne. John Hawthorne, you may know, is the most famous because he was the most aggressive of the three. He was assuming that you were guilty until proven otherwise. Another problem with the law nowadays. You cannot assume that somebody is guilty until proven otherwise. So he would assume that in the interrogations, and you can see because it's all transcribed, he would say, okay, so you're a witch. And he would say things like, for example, Rebecca Nurse, who was one of the people who got executed, he said, no, she would say, I'm not a witch. And I said, well, what is a witch? And she said, I don't know what a witch is, but because I'm not a witch. And he said, well, so how can you know that you're not a witch if you don't know what a witch is? So those are the methods that he was used to interrogate. And after that, he would persist and he would say, okay, so you're a witch. And he would execute. Rebecca Nurse was a relatively respected person in town. And she would go to church every Sunday, and she was very respected by the community, and she got executed. So it was one of the most, you know, renowned cases of the time. And then Jonathan Corwin. Let's go to next slide. Samuel Sewall apologized for at the time before he died for what he did. And Putman Jr., the one of the first people who accused, apologized as well publicly. So some people apologized after what happened. This is a mistake. This is not Samuel Sewall House. This is Jonathan Corwin House. So if you go to Salem and you go visit, this is the only house that is still standing related to the witchcraft trials, and is in Salem. There is another one, the House of Rebecca Nurse, but it's not in Salem. It's in the village area, but not in Salem. And these people, you pay $60 now to see, but there is just an exhibit, a recreation. There is a museum of the witches that you can visit, but it's just an exhibit. So, but you want to see something historical from the time, is this house or the gravestone of Jonathan Hawthorne as well. The grave of William Stoughton is here in Boston at Mount Aubrey, and you can visit the grave of William Stoughton as well. So, yeah, this is the witch house. If you go to Salem, they call it the witch house. It's part of the touristic attractions there. Okay, Jonathan Corwin's house. Next. This is part of the monument. This is the execution that I talk about. Sarah Good, who was having problems with the Putman family. And she was one of the first person to be accused, and she was hung to death in July 19th, 1692. There were two moments. One was in July, and then 3 months later they did a new series of accusations and executions as well. I think it was between July and October, or July and September, or something like that. Okay, next. John and Elizabeth Proctor. This is a depiction of from 19th century as well. John Proctor was executed. His family is still... it's an interesting case because he was a respected, marriage, and they had the wife had just become pregnant. So because he couldn't, if you were pregnant, you couldn't be executed at the time. You were pregnant because the baby was innocent technically. So she was put in jail, and he was executed. By the time William Phipps dissolved the court after his wife was accused, then the wife, Elizabeth Proctor, was released. So the descendants of the Proctor family are still around, and they always live in the monument of the witches. They always live at John Proctor. They always leave something there with their names and everything. The interesting thing is that William Stoughton, he suffered possibly psychiatrically from malignant narcissism, because when William Phipps ordered to dissolve the court, he got so angry that before the order of the dissolution of the court was effective, he ordered to execute all the people in jail, including the pregnant women, but he was stopped from doing that. So just to prove himself right, just because he was so angry that somebody was telling him that he was possibly wrong, which, you know, psychiatry, we can see that malignant narcissism. Next, Martha and Giles Corey. You can see, if you go to Salem Cemetery, where the witch trial memorial is, this is the oldest cemetery in town, you can see the gravestone of the wife, the first wife of Giles Corey. But Giles Corey and Martha Corey, we don't know where they are. But Giles Corey was much older than Martha, and he was a farmer, but he had estate. So if you were accused of being a witch, they would take the estate from you. So he knew the law, and he said, okay, so I'm not going to plead guilty or innocent. So if you don't plead, Martha Corey was executed, and she pleaded innocent, and she got executed. And these are depictions. This is a depiction of the 19th century of John Hawthorne together with Cotton Mather. There is John Hawthorne on the left, Cotton Mather on the right, and they are interviewing Martha Corey. And then she got executed. And then Giles Corey, what you see on the right, another 19th century depiction, where you see Giles Corey knew the law, and he was older, and he knew the law, and he didn't plead guilty or innocent. So then you could torture the person so that they plead. But because he didn't plead, they started putting stones on his body, and all these stones on his body, eventually he died from, he was suffocated. And, you know, legend says his last words were, more weight. So he was pressed to death. He was the only victim that was pressed to death. Also, two people died in prison, and the rest of the people were hanged. There was nobody burned at the stake. They followed the English methods of the time. So Giles Corey was pressed to death with the stones. Next slide. Okay, so another example of John Hawthorne. This is the slide that I showed you before. And here is a transcript. I cannot read it now, but how John Hawthorne, you can use all the transcripts, but John Hawthorne, from a psychiatric viewpoint, is interesting because he would assume, okay, so how do we, can you tell us why you are a witch? You know, like, just assume that you're a witch. So he was really suggesting, and this is something that would be completely not tolerated nowadays. In addition, they were using spectral evidence. In addition, they were using physical exams. So imagine. Okay, next slide. George Burroughs was the priest, the reverend. Reverend George Burroughs. He quit Salem Village because he said he was not paid, being paid the full salary. He got accused too, you know, so you can see. So they executed George Burroughs, the prior reverend. So this is interesting because we always say, well, the outcasts and the mentally ill were accused. But here we see all the layers in society being accused, including the wife of the governor, so or the priest. So there were political accusations, but it affected all layers in society, not only the outcast. Okay, let's go to next. George Jacobs, he was 83. This is a famous painting of the time from 19th century. He was accused by his granddaughter. And they used another thing. Most of the accusers were underage. So here we see the trial of George Jacobs being accused by his granddaughter. He got executed. They found the body of George Jacobs because he was buried next to his older house. And they put, they saw he had arthritis and he used two canes at the time. He was 83 at the time. Imagine 83 and dying like this, being accused of being a witch. And but eventually he was buried in another area next to Rebecca Nurse House, which is an area where they put the cemetery for victims of witchcraft. Next slide. Yeah, this Rebecca Nurse, who was a very respected member in society. This is her older house, and now she had another estate, and in the other estate where George Burroughs is buried, and many of the bodies haven't been found yet. Some people still argue that they are in a mountain. In the 19th century, they would say it was in a little hill there, and that's where they put the monument, but they haven't detected most of the bodies. But this is another 19th century depiction of Rebecca Nurse, who was this respected member in the community, and also her house that was, until the beginning of 20th century, was still standing, and that's a photograph of her house. Next. This is the gravestone of John Hawthorne. He lived much longer. He lived until 76 years old, and you can read there, here lies interred the body of John Hawthorne, age 76 years, who died in May 1717. So he got to live for 20 more years, and 25 more years. Here you see the typical New England gravestones with the memento mori, that they use a skull with wings, and also they use an angel with wings, or a Greek hern with a Greek palm tree. So if you come to New England, it's very nice to see the old cemeteries. It's some of the most historical documents. And this is the memento mori, which is, you know, very pertinent to the culture of the time. Okay, so next. You can visit that in the Salem Cemetery, where you have also the Salem witch trial. So there were 21 victims, 19 executed, 2 died in prison. And these are the numbers of victims, like Bridget Bishop, Sarah Good, Rebecca Nurse that we talk about, Elizabeth Ho, Susanna Marlin, Sarah Wiles, George Burroughs that we talk about, the Reverend, George Jacobs that we talked about as well, Martha Carrier, John Proctor, Elizabeth Proctor, John Wheeler, Martha Corey that we talk about. We've mentioned a few examples, but well, all of them we have information. Gilles Corey, Sarah Osborne, Sarah Good, Anne Foster. And they were all spread through all the Salem Village. No, they were not from Salem City. They were from Salem Village. So it's a wider area. Okay, next. So this is really a human tragedy, and in 1992 they decided to do a memorial for them. And I really like this place. I've been a few times because it's in the cemetery, so you can see the old cemetery. and it's really congruent with the landscape of the time. You have some trees, and then you get like some stones where you can see original testimonies of the time. I'm not a witch. I'm innocent. I don't know what a witch is. God knows that I'm not a witch. So all this is transcribed into these stones, and then you have like little benches made of stone with the same color, where you can see the names of the people, and you can go across this park. And people normally leave flowers and things like that. So it's a nice thing, because this is really a human tragedy. And when they inaugurated, they call Arthur Miller, and also they call the Nobel Peace Prize of the time. And they read some things. They say witchcraft is something that happens nowadays. There are witch hunts. They happen all the time. And we can change the witchcraft accusation or the witch hunt inside us, because we all are. We are. It's very easy for us to see the victims and identify with the victims. It's very easy for us, but we don't see that we are the victims, but we are also the aggressors. And we, in our nature, is the same nature of accusing somebody fakely. We are all capable of that, as capable as identifying with the victims. And we want to see the good, but we don't want to see the evil within ourselves. I think that's kind of like the message for today. Okay, next slide, and we're almost finishing. So for psychiatric theory, it's been explained that there is a theory of ergots in the rye, and this is the psychedelic theory. It's very cool, because, I mean, for us who like psychedelics, but it's really, really unlikely. What we've been seeing here is political accusations, political opportunism to get rid of the person that you don't like. That has happened in history over and over again. It happened with the accusation of the Jews throughout history, and it's even happening nowadays, because I think... sometimes we call it shared psychosis, folie simultanee, mass hysteria, whatever. But it's really accusations. Every time you have an ontology, a belief in society that becomes very important for society, there are going to be people who are victims, who are being fakely accused. And I say that for all the beliefs that we have nowadays, whether it's fascism, nationalism, feminism, even anti-racism, there are going to be people who become radical about it, and there are going to be people who are going to be fakely accused, and we're going to have a hard time seeing this innocent victim. So it's a good reflection for all of us. Every dogma, if it becomes radical, there are going to be fake accusations and there are going to be victims. And if we really embrace the dogma, no matter how good we believe the dogma is, like Christianity or fighting the witches, or we are fighting for the planet or whatever we're fighting for, there are going to be communism or whatever, there are going to be innocent victims. And we see that over and over again in history. Okay, next slide. Yeah, lessons learned, spectral evidence, of course, you know, wouldn't happen today. Justice bias, all the time, even nowadays. But we still need the justice, because otherwise people would take justice in their own hands. But justice is not perfect by any means, but it's better than taking justice in your own hands. That would be less perfect. Witch hunts, nowadays, we continue to see fake accusations, innocent victims all the time, and we have a hard time seeing it because we really embrace the ideas of our society at the time. So if you're in the 17th century, it's very easy to embrace Puritanism. Nowadays, people would embrace Puritanism, but we're embracing other ideas. And the ideas that we are embracing, if they are dogmatic, we are going to see fake accusations, we're going to see victims, and we're going to accuse those people or believe those accusations, and we're going to be part of the problem. This is something that our psychology hasn't changed in that regard. With radicalism, our psychology hasn't changed. All belief systems and ontologies may involve the accusation of innocent people before, now, and in the future. We identify the victims, but we don't identify with the aggressors. This is the important, this is the memorial that did more recently, where in the hill where they think they could be buried, but they haven't found the bodies there. So this, you go to Salem, you can visit that too. Okay, next. Okay, so this is all for today. Sorry it took a little bit longer, but, and sorry I couldn't share the slides. For next year, I will try to log in earlier and see what's wrong with my computer. This is a picture of me for people who haven't seen me today. They have been seeing Conrad. I've been seeing Conrad. Thanks. That's a nice view. Maybe he's better looking than me for sure. This is a picture of me in one of the last few times I was at Salem. And this is the gravestone of John Hawthorne. And this is me. It was rainy. It was a July day, very rainy. And I was next to the gravestone of John Hawthorne that is restored in a way. But you can see the original transcription there. And I like to go there and visit because I'm a big fan of horror depictions and things like that. And I like to reflect on where we are now and where we were at the time. This is my personal email, my work email, my phone number as well. I don't care if somebody wants me to send a text, no problem with that too. And, feel free to reach out for any question. And it's been a great pleasure to be here with you one more time. Hopefully next year we can do it in person.
Thank you so much, Dr. Espy Forsen. We always appreciate you coming. We appreciate this new tradition that we've kind of developed with you. And I will say, though, I want to at least leave a minute or two. I know we're kind of pushing towards time to any questions at all. Just an opportunity to ask any questions if anyone has any via chat or kind of reading out loud.
Hi, Dr. Espy Forsen. Thank you so much for the presentation. That was so cool. I wasn't expecting anything. I'm Mindy. I'm a medical student from Wayne State. So what can we as training psychiatrists in training like do to best train ourselves to not be bogged down by mainstream dogma, radicalism, falsehood? Like, what can we do?
Yeah, I think that's the main message and the main question. I think the best thing we can do ourselves is to check with ourselves and not believe in any dogma. I mean, that's some people don't like it when I say this because they say, no, you should believe in something. I was like, well, I can believe in the good or in the connection, or but if I embrace a dogma that they are trying to tell me, I know I'm one step away from becoming fanatical. And then it becomes a matter of validation and believing in it. We start becoming Machiavellian about it, about the lesser evil to justify the big benefit or benefit in society. It happened with communism. There were multiple executions. It happened with fascism. And nowadays, with the dogmas that we have in our society, it's nice. I mean, who is against equality, who is against diversity. But if it becomes dogmatic for you, if it becomes like radical about it, then you are going to be vulnerable to be one of these aggressors. So I wouldn't believe in any dogma as a matter of faith. You can share, but always have an intellectual approach to everything. Yeah, thank you everyone for your attendance. I'm here in Boston, so for anything, feel free to reach out. I'm very approachable. And it's been, honestly, I'm really happy when I get your email every year because here I can talk about the things I really care about, and I'm very happy that there is an interest. So thank you so much for the invitation. This is really meaningful to me to be here.
Bye, everyone. Thanks again.
Bye-bye. Bye, team.